Lowe's knows how to help make your home holiday ready for less. Get Select Style Selections vinyl flooring for just $1.99 per square foot and have it installed before the festivities begin. Our team can help you every step of the way. See a Lowe's Red Vest associate or visit lowes.com/holiday install to get started. Lowe's, we help, you save. Basic install only. Date restrictions apply. Subject to availability. Install by independent contractor. See associate for details. Contiguous U.S. only.
This is Ryan Fitzpatrick, and you're listening to the Neil Reynolds Podcast.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 22 of the Neil Reynolds Podcast. I am your host, Neil Reynolds, and this week my guest is a good friend. You will all know him from the Around the NFL podcast. Known as the Quiet Storm, the wonderful Mark Sessler, very funny guy, very entertaining on the podcast and when you get with him in real life as well. So I hope you enjoy this. If you are enjoying the series so far, then please leave us a review on iTunes, give us a rating. That all helps as we spread the word. But let's get to our podcast with Mark Sessler. And in his formative years, Mark had been an honorary Brit. It was in the early 1980s and living in Surrey with his family, NFL Sundays hadn't quite appeared on the Sessler radar. But moving back home, he was introduced to the sport he would come to love.
Well, you know, we had moved back to the States from England because we had lived there for 3 years in the Surrey area, which I feel like I've mentioned roughly 400 times to you. But my dad was working for Xerox, and we came back to the States, and my dad was really happy because this was essentially around 1980 or so, and football back then was not readily available, obviously, in the UK. And so he would watch these, he described it as packages of highlights that would filter in about a week later. You would know yep. better than I, but yourself would have been quite young then. But so anyways, we came back to the States. And so on Sundays, you know, down in our living room, my dad would watch football happily for the first time in years. And I remember my first memory of watching pro football was just to my, you know, six-year-old self. I thought that they all were in their 50s and 60s. I didn't know, or I couldn't fathom that they were only 20 years old. So I always asked my dad, like, how big are they? How tall are they? And I remember one time, he was very engaged in the game, and he didn't get annoyed at me, but I had asked like 100 questions, and I kept asking if like the taller players were taller than Chewbacca or not, because I was obsessed with Star Wars and Star Wars figures. But from there, it kind of graduated to my first real memory of a game that I can really remember sitting down and watching and understanding that there were high stakes was the Raiders Washington Super Bowl, where Marcus Allen ran wild. And we watched that, you know, around the living room with pizza on Super Bowl Sunday. And it was this game that I don't have a lot of memories of, but I do distinctly remember Marcus Allen in that game.
I'm going to beg producer Carrie to leave this part out, but I'm just going to say it to you, Mark. So our two worlds kind of collide in terms of sharing two of the same passions, NFL and Star Wars. So when I was a child, you know, the Star Wars figures?
Yeah.
So I used to get the Star Wars figures and put them in offensive formations. So so Chewie was a tight end.
Makes
I had
sense.
The, what were those ones? They were called like the Gamorrean guards. You remember
from
Jabba the
Hutt? Big thick guys with the horns.
So they were the guards. Han Solo was the quarterback.
I had
put way too much time. I can't remember the rest of the lineup, but it's a bit sad, isn't it?
Well, you were ahead of me because I wouldn't have even known how to line them up in formation back when that all began. But there is a link there. That makes sense. Yeah.
So why the Browns? Why the Cleveland Browns? Well, you weren't from Cleveland, were you, when you went back?
I lived on the East Coast in a part of Connecticut that's close to New York City. And so, you know, long before cable television was in our house or you really, you know, like today can watch every game, you were stuck with whatever teams were around you. And so we got the Giants and Jets week after week. And this was around 1986. And the Giants were becoming the Giants. They had been to the playoffs the year before. And Bill Parcells was rounding them into Super Bowl shape. But all my friends were Giants fans and some were Jets fans. And I just, something about it didn't click with me. I found the Giants to be this should show you where my roots of analysis come from. I found them to be boring because they only gave up about 10 points a game and scored 13 and were 8-0, and I just thought that was dull. And I had a friend, I was in middle school, and I had a friend move to town from Cleveland. His name was Chris Sprigg. And interestingly enough, our middle school had this little dinky AV club where you could, you know, you could get a video camera and start to do little news reports and things like that. So he and I got very hooked into that. And that really started my passion for news and reporting. And so he was my first kind of, you know, the way that today I were paired in the ATN group and you have these people that you kind of travel and do these experiences with. That was Chris Sprague and I, and he was a huge Browns fan. And so I was looking for a team, and I initially was sort of a Cowboys fan. That didn't click. And so I started to track the Browns a little. And there was a night in 1986 when they played your Dolphins and Dan Marino on Monday Night Football. And I believe this was in November or so. And the Browns themselves went 12-4 that year under Marty Schottenheimer and Bernie Kosar. And their offense became watchable and fun. They had Kevin Mack. They had Ernest Biner, Webster Slaughter. And I just fell in love. And I literally think it was that night. And I was a Pop Warner football player. And it was after a Pop Warner banquet. And I was staying over at a friend's house, Peter Acton, who was another huge football friend of mine in my life. And I was like, he was a Cowboys fan. I said, I'm leaving the Cowboys. The Browns are my team. And, you know, a couple months later, the Giants win the NFC Championship. Hours in between where the Browns lost on the drive. And so I was totally heartbroken. And all my friends at school were like excited because the Giants had been hot garbage for a long time. They were all about to experience the first Super Bowl win. The Browns coming off the drive would have the fumble the next year. But these losses, instead of me running away from them and jumping back on the Giants bandwagon, somehow like dug me back in deeper. And I got so obsessed that I knew all the names of their wives, their girlfriends. Like I was, you know, I had a little computer at that point and was writing spreadsheets about rosters and stats and making my own little magazine. So the Browns became, at a time when, you know, you're in middle school, you're a kid, you have no real ability to go experience the outdoor world, outside world on your own. They became like a mega obsession. And it just stuck and got deeper and deeper as the years went on.
Oh, it's like listening to myself. I had A4 pad after A4 pad of Miami Dolphins stats. And then I'd write newsletters on my dad's old typewriter. You know, you have to whack the keys really hard to get the ink to come out. And then my mum would say, what are you doing with those? I was like, no, they're just for me. I don't know. I don't know what I'm doing. And my dad would then yell at me and tell me to do proper schoolwork rather than that. Oh, it's funny. And I remember the drive. I was 14. And then I was 15 when I remember the fumble in the 87 championship game. They kind of set you up for what was to come, Mark, in a way, with the Browns, you know, quite a bit. And now you won't look at that sort of disappointment with so much romance, I wouldn't have thought.
No, I mean, the fumble hurt me more because Ernest Biner was my favorite player. And I think what's forgotten whenever they show these, it feels like NFL Network, there was a period where they'd play the fumble and the drive like literally every time I was at work on like 18 televisions, sending a message to me, perhaps trying to rid me out of the company. Yeah, but
we'll get him out.
Yeah, I mean, Biner was so pivotal to that team. They would never have gotten there without him. And Marty Schottenheimer said that Ernest Biner was like a son. And honestly, one of the greatest things about getting into the NFL now and meeting people here and there is having like met Ernest Biner a few times, because he was legit like that, you know, and you have your version of this, like my football hero. And I looked up to him, but it wasn't just the player and the stats. It was kind of the person that he was. And so I always felt that that was a total injustice to him and what that team was all about, but he made good of it. And, but that, you know, to experience those back-to-back sports heartaches in sixth and seventh grade, that alters your view, not only of sports, but of, I think, of the world a little bit. I think it changed me, and I really don't think I'd even be doing what I'm doing today without it, because it put me on this course where it's like, I'm not leaving this team until they win the Super Bowl. And it's been a rather rocky, road since.
Yeah, I mean, you and I both. My team got to the Super Bowl in the second year I supported them. I became a Dolphins fan in 83. 84, they were at the Super Bowl. 85, they were in the championship game. I was like, this is great. I've picked the right team. They're going to be there every year. Not even close since.
Then you get dropped into a volcano.
The volcano Mark describes is the one we all know he lives in to this day, as we witness his levels of stress and anxiety every game week with the Browns. It wasn't always like that for him, of course, just as it isn't for any NFL fan. Mark's gateway into his Browns fandom is one filled with pleasant memories, memories of a time spent with his dad, father and son, just watching football, pretty much like the first game he attended live.
You know, that's probably one of my favorite experiences with my dad, because it would have been, it was 1988, and, you know, we lived on the East Coast, and as a surprise for my birthday was in October, but he said, "Your birthday present is coming. It's in the mail. Like, it's going to get here in November, but be patient." And one time we got in the car to go do chores. It's like, really? What are we doing this for? And he had packed a bag secretly for both of us, and we drove to the airport, and he announced basically, like, "We're going to Cleveland. We're watching the Browns play the Steelers." And this was in November. It was really close to Bernie Kosar's birthday. It was a wicked, rainy, rough day. And we were seated, thankfully, in old Cleveland Stadium underneath the roof section. But I had a clear view of the dog pound. The place was rocking. And for me, the first moment that I really remember was, because I had seen Cleveland Stadium 1,000 times on television, and to walk into it, you know how that experience when you're in a big venue like that, and you walk past one of the open tunnels that gives you a view from, you know, inside the belly of the stadium down onto the field. And it was a 4 o'clock game, I believe, and it was cold and gray. And I just saw Bernie Kosar underneath the Klieg lights, the brilliant lights that lit up the field, throwing a pass in warmups, and my heart skipped a beat. And my dad had brought binoculars, and so I was able to, you know, from a distance, close up through binoculars, look at all my heroes, and they ripped the Steelers a new one that day. It's a team that got back on track with that win. And, you know, I always used to tell people, like, they'd say, "What's the greatest vacation you had?" And, you know, people are saying, "We went to the Bahamas," or "We went skiing in Colorado." I was like, no, it's when I went for like 36 hours to Cleveland with my dad to watch the Browns. Like, you know, back then Cleveland, and still it's like, people like, "Cleveland was your favorite vacation? You seem like a demented individual."
It's funny now, because we get to sit in press boxes at the Super Bowl, or our Sky Sports studio is in a fantastic spot. But I don't think there's anything ever beats that first time. Like you say, you walk in through the tunnel and you catch the glimpse of the field. For me, it was a game in London. It was the American Bowl preseason game. I didn't get tickets to the first one in 86, but I went to Denver against the LA Rams in 87, and just that first glimpse of NFL players on the field, I don't think, you're right, it's special. I don't think it ever changes.
No, you don't forget it. You don't. And I think it leads us a little bit to what we, or it added emphasis to what we do today and what we're lucky to do.
Now, Mark's visits to watch his beloved Browns have not always been quite so romantic or plain sailing. One road trip during his college days certainly stands out for all the wrong reasons.
This was a disaster. Yeah, this was a mess. I was in college. I went to Miami of Ohio. People think, oh, University of Miami down in warm Miami. I went to Miami of Ohio, which is close to Cincinnati. And honestly, one of the reasons I went there was because my goal was just to zip through college as fast as possible and go work for the Browns. And I thought, if I can go to this school, I'd have access to go to some of their games. And there was a girl in our dorm who was sort of the RA, which is like the dorm, not dorm mom, but she sort of made sure people weren't going totally crazy in the dorms. And she lived in Cleveland. Her parents invited a few of us up to go stay for the weekend and go to a Browns game. And it was Belichick's Browns versus Elway and the Broncos. This was 1992. It was a bad Browns team. I think Mike Tomczak was the quarterback. But anyways, we got in this car, and she had borrowed the car from a friend, and it was a Chevy Nova, which in Spanish means no go. I was not a good car, but this guy was like, "This is my only possession, like, take care of it." And we got about an hour and a half up onto the highway that connects Cincinnati and Cleveland. And, you know, we were a bunch of us packed into the car, and I was in the back seat with this other guy. And I looked out, something did not smell right. We looked out the back window, and we couldn't see the highway behind us because, like clouds of smoke were covering the back of the car. And it's like, this car is in big trouble. And so we said, let's just pull over on the side of the road. And we did. And, you know, none of us knew anything about cars. But at one point, like, we opened up the hood of the car and it exploded in this like disgusting kind of green blobby juice. And a trucker pulled over, thankfully, and he was like a real man. And he said, look at that, the antifreeze tank has exploded, like, and you have a problem. And then suddenly there was a burst of flame underneath like the back tire area. And this big burly trucker guy just said, run. And I grabbed my bag and my camera and ran up this hill next to the highway. We all did. And within 5 or 10 minutes, the car exploded into flame. And suddenly there were police and ambulance. The whole highway shut down for hours. The car burnt to the ground and we were all fine, but we were taken by ambulance to a rest stop about an hour outside of Cleveland. Cause we were fine. They let us go. And then this poor kid's dad had to drive an hour down and pick the four of us up. And, you know, half of us didn't have possessions. So, and then the Browns lost 10-0 in what was like their first home shutout in decades. So,
you didn't go to the game still.
Oh, yeah, we did. No, I don't care what's burnt to the ground. But I mean, the Browns rewarded us with a 10-0 loss. So the weekend was a mess. It was a mess. Yeah.
I can't believe you went through all that and still went to the game. That's not right.
The good thing is I had my camera with me and I took a couple photos and it got published in the Miami of Ohio school paper with all of us sort of, you know, once the car had been doused by police and fire people, with all of us sort of huddled in front of this burnt car. And she had to go back and describe it. She was very nervous because she had to go tell this guy who I think she maybe kind of liked or something. Not only don't I have your car, no one has your car. It's gone forever.
And you were there on the spot taking pictures. Yes. You were on your way as a reporter.
Bingo.
Let's talk about, so what jobs did you go for after college, before you get to NFL Network and get to the NFL? Just give me a 30-second snapshot of career of Mark Sessler.
Well, people all the time say, how did you get into sports? And it's like, I really didn't, not for almost, you know, 15 years, because I wanted to do all that. I worked for USA Today's Baseball Weekly as a senior in college and had a chance to interview for newspapers, but I decided to move to New York to live with friends and try to be a novelist, which is totally pretentious. That did not happen. I sort of moved west to about 6 or 7 cities and wound up in LA in 2004, wanting to be a screenwriter, also pretentious, didn't work out, and got a job editing copy 3 days a week at NFL.com through a friend. And I had no idea what I was doing. I was lucky I didn't get fired, but you know, I kind of week after week kept working, got a little bit better at it, learned the system, and then everything started to grow as NFL.com grew. Dan Hansa showed up, et cetera, et cetera.
Had you been a journalist? Had you been a copy reader at least, or what had taken you to,
because,
to be there at NFL.com?
I was this really obsessed, nerdy high schooler that, again, we had a television station at our school, and by in high school, we had a really legit one that had a closed circuit cable channel. And so that same friend, Chris Sprague, and I, would wear suits and announce basketball games. I remember doing a 3-hour broadcast of a gymnastics meet and I had no idea what I was doing. I mean, that was the start. And I walked around with like a Bob Costas football card in my wallet. And so I went to college thinking this is the only thing I want to do. I just want to work for the Browns or be in broadcasting. But back then, unlike today, there were no opportunities. And I wrote every NFL team. And, you know, I got letters back, but every one of them said, thank you, but not that you're too young, but you could tell like they weren't going to hire like a 19 or 20-year-old. So I moved away from it because I just couldn't crack in. And I think, frankly, like I didn't want to be the guy working like a local political beat in like the middle of Idaho for 3 hours when all my friends were somewhere else. So I came back to it much later in life.
You said, so you go to NFL.com, you're editing, I assume editing other people's work to begin with.
Oh, yeah.
And then
mine.
You start. Right. And then, so who's the first one of the around the NFL guys that you get to know then?
Well, so the first one that showed up was Dan. He came about maybe 2 weeks after I did, in the same role, 3 days a week, and he had moved across the country for it. And, you know, I always like to tell him I taught him how to do our CMS, our content management system. Without that, he would be nothing today. Not true. But he was a much he had come from an area where he had worked for Major League Baseball, and he was just a more experienced journalist. And I was still very worried about keeping the role. And the lockout happened shortly after Dan and I arrived. And I think we both thought we're going to be axed here. But the good thing was they were axing people who were making real money. We were making peanuts. So we're like, we can work these guys for next to nothing. And so our roles kind of expanded. And then Greg showed up, I would say maybe a year and a half later, from Pro Football Talk. And then Greg brought Wes in a year, maybe a year after that. So Dan and I had this little tiny 15-minute show that we would do that Dave Damashek, thank you to Dave Damashek, was so nicely would put on the end of his ragingly popular podcast, and it was the Debate Club. And then when Greg arrived and Wes arrived, we expanded it to the back then I think it was the Around the League show.
We'll be back with more from Mark Sessler after this short break.
Hi, I'm Bruce Arians, and you're listening to the Neil Reynolds Podcast.
Welcome back to my conversation with Mark Sessler from Around the NFL. Now, before the break, we heard all about Mark's early experiences following the Cleveland Browns. At one time, he even attended a game after an ill-fated road trip, saw the car he was traveling in end up in flames. So with all that life experience, he was ready to have Greg Rosenthal for a boss. Yes, you've heard it here first. Greg Rosenthal was once the boss of Mark, Chris Westlin, and Dan Hansus.
Oh yeah, Greg was our boss. And in fact, when Greg was hired,
I don't know why I didn't know that.
No, that's why we call him the old boss on the show today. Because he moved out of that role. And I think that, you know, because I think that as things changed, like being in management over us and stuff probably was not fun. I think we were not the easiest. But he came and, you know, he had to decide what people he wanted to keep on his staff. And I had met Greg before, and we got along pretty well, but I really was still very raw, and I was still learning football, frankly, from a analysis angle. And so he could have gone and gotten much more experienced, bigger names. And he kept me, he kept Dan. I mean, there was a process to it, but you know, I think he saw how much we wanted it, and we had been there. But I think when he brought in Wes, for instance, that's probably more the type of person, you know, I'm imagining that he had worked with and knew that. Right. Wes came in as a very experienced football guy. So there, you know, it was an adventure. But I owe it to Greg for not just basically throwing me out on the pavement.
It is a hugely successful podcast, and you know I'm a big fan. I listen to it all the time. I love having you guys involved on Sky Sports. It's been, I think, since we've had you really involved every week, it's really taken our show to a new level. Well, I think it's been so successful. Well, first of all, in America, but also, well, I can tell you why I think it's successful in the UK, because you're not afraid to poke fun at each other, and that's kind of the British way. We kind of take the mickey out of each other, as we would say. It's about you guys. It's not just about football. Why do you think it's successful?
Yeah, I think that part of it packs into the fact that there's real chemistry. I mean, there could be shows where, you know, they kind of package people together the same way you'd put a boy band together. With this player and this host would be good fits. You know, the four of us all came from very different backgrounds. I explained mine. Dan's was different. Wes, you know, was a mailman. He had all sorts of different jobs, and we all had this shared love of football. But we all came together from, you know, it was an unnatural and really strange pairing. And I think also the four of us are relatively the same age. You know, when we started, I had just had my second child, but none of the others had had kids at that point. So we've already sort of grown up in life together. But in terms of the week-to-week show, I think we each bring very different viewpoints. I mean, I see the world in a different way and football in a different way than the other three guys. And if you had four of me, I think it would leave a big chunk of football fans very unhappy. And if you had four Gregs...
Well, you're the only one who played the game, Mark. You're the only
one
who played
the game.
That
is true, and that's the differentiator. They don't want to hear this, but that's the differentiator. I mean, I peaked at around eighth grade or so, but you don't forget that experience. You don't.
Absolutely.
You don't forget it.
Yeah, it does work out. You all mix together, though. I do think that's the key, isn't it? It's not forced chemistry. It's not fake chemistry. You call each other out. I think you know how to poke each other's buttons, which is all part of the fun of it, I guess. It can get a bit heated at times. Is it all good as soon as the show's finished?
I think especially now that's the case. I mean, when we were all getting to know each other, and I can only really say from my perspective, but I am probably the most annoying of the group because I can get very emotional, and I think sometimes for me it would spill over if I'd get annoyed and I'd have to go process it at night, and I wouldn't always do a good job with that. I think I've had to learn to kind of be, I don't know how to put it into words, just a little bit less touchy-feely about certain topics. But yeah, I think that we all have our hot spots, and we've all probably offended each other and gotten on each other's nerves. I mean, I know that I have done that to them, but in the end, like, can we still work together? And is there, over the years, you know, as we all know each other's families and we've been through a lot in work and outside of work, I think there's a respect and there's friendship, and there's probably between each of us different relationships and different like levels of let's go hang out and stuff, but that's natural. But I think if it became other than that, we really couldn't keep doing it, because I think anyone listening would notice a change. And you know, certain things I think have brought us closer together too over the years.
Now, in all my years as a journalist, and there have been many, I've had the privilege of meeting and interviewing so many great characters. And there have been times when it's been quite the opposite, though, with moments and assignments I would like to forget. Mark is no different.
We had a chance to interview Sean McDermott. There was an owner's meeting where they gave us six or seven coaches. And I have a memory of Sean McDermott sitting down with us. And, you know, he was a wrestler, and we opened the interview. I remember explaining to him I'd lost to a girl in wrestling in middle school, and like, what did he think of that? And like, you know, and then Dan did his Dan thing, and Wes and Greg, and he left, and he told his PR guy, you know, that was really fun. Like, I would love to do that again. And I think that's when for us, you know, there've been moments of that where it's like, I think we can do this a little differently. We can be different around coaches. And we had a chance to sit down with Andy Reid, and like, we asked him about like he has a gigantic scar on his knee from obviously some sort of a surgery. And we asked about that little utility belt he used to wear. And again, it's just like the coaches for me are more interesting a lot of times than the players. I don't know why that is, but it's been really fun to meet some of those guys. Freddie Kitchens, no longer in the spotlight, was fascinating, like, to me, because he was the new Browns coach. But we had like a 20-minute talk after about what kind of liquors he enjoys and stuff. And so, you know, getting to know some of those people matter. In terms of like the duds, I don't know. I don't know if anyone really comes to mind, because I think anyone offering themselves up is trying. But I could say that we've had a few during this remote period where we're all kind of on different laptops in our homes, where we've had a few players where their connections have been so bad that you're just thinking this is the most awkward conversation, or certain players that just don't offer anything other than like clipped two or three word answers. So we don't do a lot of player interviews, I think, for that reason, because they're hit or miss. When they're good, they're really good, and when they're bad, you're kind of left thinking, do we want to put that in the show or not?
Right. Yeah. I'm kind of with you on the not looking to chase a headline sort of interview. I've never really done those kinds of interviews. And I think it's because I travel with players around the country on the UK live tours. So it's a more relaxed atmosphere anyway. And it's kind of jokey and jovial. But even recently when I interviewed Aaron Rodgers, I didn't really ask him about, I asked him in a jokey way about Jordan Love, one question, but the rest of it was more kind of, and that was even, I framed that as, how far did you throw the remote control of your TV? You know, it was, but the rest of it, he was so relaxed. He was talking about meeting fans in a Packers bar in Paris. I think you get more out of players when they realize that you're not after, you know, some kind of criticism of the Minnesota Vikings or something. It's more harmless, I think, that way. What about Super Bowls? So I'll just give you an example of one. Obviously, a kind of Super Bowl I'll never forget it moment was, for me, I was on the goal line presenting from the sidelines for Sky Sports when Malcolm Butler made the interception of Russell Wilson. I've said that before on this podcast. Any of those kind of moments, you know, and you guys have joined us for a few, you know, we had the incredible Philadelphia and New England game, followed by the Snorefest that was the Rams and New England. But any kind of real Super Bowl moments that stand out to you?
Well, I really would. I'm not just saying this. I have really vivid memories of that Patriots-Eagles Super Bowl, and sitting up in the booth with you guys. And, you know, the game, it was just a very unique experience because we were analyzing and discussing the game as it was happening. It was happening right before us, and that game was crazy. And, but to me, it was surreal, but also, like the thing I'll probably remember the most about our travels together in general are our two trips to London and, you know, getting a chance to do the sideline reporting during that Bucks, Panthers game, just stuff that we never have, you know, we probably would not be doing that in the States in our current roles at all. And so that's really special. And, the Super Bowls are always unique. I think, you know, I tire of Super Bowl week, but there was one Seahawks one where, you know, I'm standing next to Russell Wilson, talking to him, asking a question. I'm with Earl Thomas. I'm suddenly with Pete Carroll. And they gave me like 5 minutes alone with Pete Carroll. And it's like, you're in a week where you kind of get home from Super Bowl week and you're maybe that first night where you're just able to like forget about football for a little bit. And all these memories rush through and the Super Bowls are intense. The one last one I'll mention.
Yeah.
That Seahawks Patriots Super Bowl coming off of Deflategate, and it was in Arizona, and we were up high up in the stadium, but the tunnel where the Patriots were coming out of, I will never forget, it was a very Seahawks-heavy crowd, and they Belichick comes out of the tunnel with the hood over his head, and the place booed him like he was Darth Vader times six, and then Tom Brady appeared, and the Patriots fans went nuts, and I had never been in a louder environment in my entire life, and I think to the end, I will remember those couple of minutes, the drama of it, the intensity, and the fact that this Patriots team had been through so much that week, and it, you know, and created their own drama, and then that game and what it became. I mean, it was like probably the one Super Bowl memory where I just felt overwhelmed, and it was like, I'm supposed to be writing something during this or processing this. Like, you know, sometimes you just want to drink it in.
One of my favorite shows we've ever done on Sky Sports was week one of the 2018 season. And normally they'll tell me, you know, the week before the show, okay, it's a 1+2 this week, Neil, or it's a 1+3, as in it's me plus two guests or me plus three guests. And they're like, it's a 1+6. I had Solomon Wilcots and Rob Ryan on one table, and then you four guys on another, like six guests in the studio the whole night. You started drinking something dubious, which definitely looked like alcohol live on TV, but I'm not gonna suggest it was, as your Browns went down the pan again. But do you enjoy coming back to the UK and seeing the growth of the game here?
I will, before this gets away from me, I will confirm that it was not alcohol, but it was something that livens the spirit, and it was offered in your tub of drinks to us, but you're only supposed to have one, and I had four or five, because I mean, that had been like a 14-hour day, and suddenly like
I know what you're drinking.
You know how that studio is. I had never done that before, and it was commercial break in this gigantic camera on a crane was like suddenly a foot from my head, and it was like, what are your thoughts on Jaguars Texans? And I'm like, what's happening? So, you know, it was just like trying not
it's
to look
nonstop.
Like a it really
it's
is.
Nonstop.
I gained a huge admiration for what you guys do. I mean, now we'll come on during a commercial break. I feel like we got the easier side of the coin there, but no, going to London is incredible. And it's not just because for me, it was a chance to go back to a place I lived, but to go with the people that we went with. And I think our show is the anchor of it, the core of it, are the UK listeners and the listeners beyond, outside of the States. And the people that we've met over there, the chance to do a couple live shows, another thing that you just would never be able to do otherwise. I mean, I don't think any of us would ever, we don't take that lightly. It's just sort of an unbelievable experience. And one thing about our show that's really cool, and I think you mentioned it with the link to the sensibility of the UK fan base and beyond, is just that there aren't jerks that listen to our show. There aren't like, you know, annoying, uber critical, unfriendlies. It's the opposite. And when we've done meetups and met with people, you know, they've gone on for 2 or 3 hours because you're meeting people that you've interacted with a bunch on Twitter and other places, but, there's just a real connection there. And I don't want to sound like, I mean that genuinely, like, and I came home like from the first London trip, honestly pondering like how to get back there and stay there, because it felt like the coolest place I'd been to in a long time.
Oh, now you're talking, but it is, you're right. To be around, I did an interview today, and earlier today I did an interview asking about London games and my favourite memories. And I said a lot, so many of them are just fan memories. You know, I'll walk out to tailgate at 9 o'clock on a Sunday morning and I'm shaking hands with the fans who I see there in the front row every single tailgate. I'm very fortunate to see the same people. And you're right, I remember coming up last year, we'd done the show on the Thursday night out at Tottenham. We did a live show together and then you guys did your own kind of live recording of the podcast. And I just said to my wife, Julie, we need to go. We'll go up and spend the night. And we watched the show and then we're all there drinking with the fans for a couple of hours afterwards. It's a great community of fans here. It really is. And it feels like a community still, even though the numbers are growing year on year.
Yeah. The first time I went, in fact, we met, for the first time, I believe then, because we were sitting at a little table. It was the week that the Bills played the Jaguars and we were out on that, the countryside setting, right?
The Grove. Out in the Grove, I think it was.
Yeah, it was the Grove. And like, I think that I was, as much of an idiot to be sitting with Connor Orr, pretending to do a British accent. And, you were sitting next to us and we hadn't spoken yet. And then you introduced yourself and said that you were friends with, Henry Hodgson, Handsome Hank. Yep. And I started to process what was happening. And I had been here doing this poor British accent for a bit. And I thought, what have I done? But I'm very glad that that wasn't the end of our friendship. But that week, even Connor and I went to what we thought would be, it was an on the fly little meetup, down on Regent Street. And it was this incredibly small pub with like 250 people packed in, or I don't know. I mean, a lot. And Connor and I stayed for, hours. And I checked myself at the door at one point, said, you cannot continue to drink beers. You need to stop and start to just, this is going to be a long night. I don't know if Connor took the same self advice because when we left, we had a crazy time, but, that was my first like experience with UK fans. And I thought they know their stuff. Their questions are excellent. They're really cool. And they're as passionate as any fan base. And they love our show and we love them. I mean, there was like this understanding between us and like it gave me this feeling that on these Sundays in late November when you're in the grind and you're kind of tired of football or bad games, that like that's the kind of stuff that kind of will fuel me because you're still doing these shows. Someone's still listening. I think it's easy to forget that people are listening to what you're doing at all.
Now we're seeing the NFL landscape change before our very eyes this season. The New England Patriots are a shadow of the team we've come to know. Tom Brady is wearing Tampa Bay colors, and a new batch of quarterbacks such as Lamar Jackson and Patrick Mahomes are helping redefine the position. But for all Mark has witnessed, has the NFL changed in the years since he became a fan of the sport?
Totally. I like watching like old games on YouTube, which I'm thankful that they've started to pull these full broadcasts from like, you know, the 80s and I'll watch old Browns ones, but other ones too. And you know, some things will always remain the same. You even see certain plays and formations that, you know, are duplicated still, but the quarterback position. I mean, I even think that in the next 10 years that 20 teams will look like, will have Kyler Murray type clones as their quarterbacks. Right. So, you know, we're seeing that evolution. Coaching's changing. I think the type of people that are being hired to coach is changing. The way teams are run, analytics, all this other stuff, it's much more modernized. And frankly, I think another huge difference is with social media that the players have such a huge voice. And in this country, this offseason, that's been totally magnified. But the ability for them to sell themselves, to interact with fans. I mean, none of that existed back then. I can only imagine at our age back when we were young, if you could tweet at certain Dolphins players for you and Browns for me, we would have been totally obsessive.
My goodness. I would have been, that's the word. We would not have used it wisely
not
or with moderation.
Not
in any way, shape, or form. You're a tremendous writer. You've written stuff for the London Game programs. I read your stuff on NFL.com. You're very funny in person. You're very funny when you write as well. And you obviously make a living writing and talking. Which do you prefer?
If it's something that I can write about that I like a long form that my heart is really into, I love that process. I think that when we're really busy, you know, these weeks, they go by so quickly and suddenly you're in a preview show and you've got a lot of work to do prepare for that stuff that like the weekly column, I think it's really cool to be able to do it. And sometimes I have to check myself at the door. Remember, it's like the 12-year-old you would be amazed that you get to do this. So don't overlook it. But sometimes that can feel like a chore to me, like the weekly assignment. I think that the talking and the being with the guys on the show will always be the thing that when I'm 100, I look back on and think is more impactful, more fun, more enjoyable. I tend to think that a lot of the writing stuff just goes off into a void or a black hole. I mean, it may not be true. They say, oh, but metrics suggest otherwise. But I mean, it's our shows together where you're interacting with people after because of something that you said or an argument you got into. So it's a pretty easy answer for me.
That's probably sums up where media has gone though, because a lot of our stuff goes onto the internet now. It goes onto websites. Whereas when I started out writing, it went into a magazine, which I still sitting in my office. You know, it went into a newspaper, which I still have in my loft. So you feel like actually those words went somewhere and stayed somewhere. Whereas words that you speak are just maybe air that disappear into the air. But now, I guess we don't always see whether people are reading what you, yeah, you know, I mean, there's analytics and stuff, sure, but it's not like a physical thing, is it? Do you see what I'm saying?
No, I think that's exactly right. And I mean, it feels more important to fire off 12 tweets over the course of a week that get, you know, engagement and response than it does to write an article that I'll never hear from anyone about ever again. And it's not fair to, you know, the .coms of the world. That all that stuff keeps the lights on. So I respect all that, but I think everything now it's like, you're much smarter doing like an Instagram live session. If you want to quickly, get gratification from that, but also just engage and be with people like the old, you know, the old 2000 word article, with, you know, assessing 20 players that might make the Pro Bowl. And it feels a little bit lower reward category to me.
You just said that you're going to be 100 looking back on the Around the NFL podcast, so you're not still going to be doing it. I feel like you guys are just going to sit there covered in dust and cobwebs.
Get wheeled in. We had kids for a reason. I think that it's like, you know, you hand it off to the next generation. Although I would imagine if it's anything like it is in my house, they're probably completely fed up with what I do. I think they see our show and run in the other direction at times. It probably just feels like when you're kids, you just want your dad to be fun and not stressed out about week 9 action.
That's a perfect place to end.
All right.
That was great. Thank you, Mark. I appreciate that.
Thanks.
There you are. There's my conversation with Mark Sessler. Hope you enjoyed that. Time for the mailbag now. Let's bring in producer Gary Hayes. So, Gary, I've got a question for you first. You said when we had Dan Hansus on the podcast, you'd love to go for a beer with Dan. What would you like to, where would you like to go with Mark?
I think Mark would be good for a coffee.
Yeah, nice coffee. Nice frothy coffee.
Because I feel like I don't know the guys from Rounding NFL. I haven't had that privilege of meeting them yet, but I feel like Mark would get me on an intellectual level.
I think that's fair.
I think I could sit there and break down a good book with him and talk about it, whereas I think Dan would be, let's put on some Bruce Springsteen and just rock out, man.
You've nailed it. Considering you've never met them, you've pretty much nailed it. All right, what you got for us question-wise?
Yeah, so yeah, I felt under pressure there having to answer
a question. Good. I know, I didn't tell you, did I, what I was going to ask you?
I was shocked.
You.
I was like, what?
Yeah, you like it.
So, yeah, I'm flustered here. Right, I need to get the first question. So it's from Dean Faccini. I always say, I hope I pronounce names right. I hope I've pronounced that correctly. I think I have. So Dean Faccini on Twitter, he asks, how do you see the NFL developing in the UK over the next 10 years?
I think it's going to continue to grow. Doesn't look like it's going to slow down anytime soon. I think I've said this a few times. I think we're in the conversation now when it comes to where is the next franchise relocation? I don't think the NFL wants more than 32 teams, so it would be a relocation. We've got two world-class stadiums. We've got fan support. We've got government support. I think we'll have 4 games per year for the foreseeable future once we get through this pandemic. And, I think we might have a franchise one day. I still strongly believe that.
What would we call that franchise? Not the Monarchs?
No, the London Monarchs. I don't know. London Underground? British Bulldogs.
The British Bulldogs would be good.
Would be good, wouldn't it? Yeah. I haven't gone that far. No, to be honest, I think we'll be, because we'll be sticking with whatever name it is. So that could be controversial. I could say a couple of NFL names now to suggest who I think is on the radar, but I won't.
Yeah. Let's move on. So from a London team to your best team. So who's the best team you've ever seen live over the years covering the NFL? And which team didn't you get to see that you most wish you had? And that's from Oscar Lomas.
So, yeah, good question, Oscar. I would broaden it out to be basically the sort of Tom Brady Patriots. And the team, I actually saw them live in 2007. I went to a game in Miami where they absolutely hammered the Dolphins 45-7, something like that. And they were throwing up passes to Randy Moss in triple coverage, and he was just easily catching them. Of course, they didn't win the Super Bowl that year. It would have been a perfect season. They got knocked off by the Giants. But I've been fortunate to see the Patriots in a number of live games at Wembley in 2009, 2012. They were dominant. I've seen them win Super Bowls. You know, I saw them, Tom Brady, play outstanding in a Super Bowl loss to the, you know, to the Philadelphia Eagles, where he just wasn't going to go quietly. So yeah, I think the Patriots are the team for me. Obviously, I only really see live games pretty much in Super Bowl or in Wembley or Tottenham. But I would say the Patriots, generally covering them, are historic. I'd love to, if I could have gone back in the time machine and covered any kind of era and any team, I think it would have been the 1970s Pittsburgh Steelers. They won 4 Super Bowls. They were the Steel Curtain defense, and the aggression they played with on defense, you know, with Jack Lambert, Gary, look him up after this. Jack Lambert, linebacker, no teeth, played with no teeth.
That must have been a scary sight. It was a scary sight. Teeth.
You look up Jack Lambert and you'll see how scary it was. You got Mel Blunt at corner. They were so physical, they actually led to a bunch of different rule changes, particularly in the passing game. So would love to have seen just how much the Steelers got away with and how physical they were.
Does Jack Lambert make it into your Pain Gang book?
He is in the Pain Gang book, but I couldn't interview him. I interviewed some of the greats, some of the absolute greats of the game. Jack Lambert is like a recluse. He lives in like some woods in Pennsylvania.
Really?
Yeah, it's bizarre.
I like the sound of that. Mm. Right, so on to...
It's not a bad idea now, given social distancing.
Yeah. I just like the idea that the romance of being in the woods in a little cabin, nice little stove going, couple of hot chocolate... Yep. Mark Sessler coming round to discuss books. Right. Last question is from Dave Murray, who calls himself the Dave Murray. Wow. Neil, do you think a pure pocket passer is a thing of the past? With all these mobile quarterbacks coming out with success, does that spell the end of the static thrower?
So I feel like it is leaning that way. And I think when I watch Drew Brees or Tom Brady or Philip Rivers, they're like dinosaurs from a different age. And I think a requirement of every quarterback in the next 10, 15 years is going to be that you're athletic, that you can move. Not everyone's going to be Lamar Jackson, but can you be Josh Allen? Can you be Aaron Rodgers? You know, when you need to move, you can move. I think that's going to be a requirement. I think I've had this thought for a while, and I actually asked this question during Super Bowl week last season to Kurt Warner, Hall of Fame quarterback, of course, who's been on our podcast. And Kurt said, you still need to throw from the pocket, though. So a pure pocket passer, yes, I think it's dying out. But can you deliver from the pocket and then run when you need to? That's going to be the requirement for quarterbacks going forward. But there's no doubt it's changed. You know, Dan Marino was a pocket passer. Joe Montana, pretty much a pocket passer back in the day. Now they're athletes. They're athletes who can throw, but you've got to be able to throw. That's the one thing. You know, sometimes the big knock on Lamar Jackson is if you drop back and just defend the pass, can he beat you with the pass? And he's lost some big games, playoff games, not being able to do that. So you can't just be an athlete. You've got to deliver from the pocket. But yeah, you've got to have some running skills now.
So with that as well, just to extend that question, because you mentioned Brady and Brees, who have obviously been around for a very long time. Someone like Jared Goff, where do you think that leaves in then? Because he's not really a Lamar Jackson or a Patrick Mahomes, is he? He's more of a Tom Brady. So
right, so there are limitations then. So you have limitations which you have to coach around. So the Rams are very good at play action passes. So faking the run, throwing downfield, getting Jared Goff rolling out. So he can roll out, he can move and throw on the run, but he's not really a running threat. And when you take away that style, which has happened a couple of times in the 2020 season, Miami did it to the Rams, you take it away and you make Jared Goff just drop back and try and beat you, then he is limited. So yes, if you have a physical limitation in today's NFL, I think your coaches have to coach around that, which is, of course, going to not make you as effective as Patrick Mahomes or Deshaun Watson.
Mm. Okay, so thinking of the podcast, I've got a quiet weekend. So who am I editing this weekend? Who's on next?
Well, this is a producer's nightmare. I know you don't like this, Gary, but it's going to be a magical mystery tour. In other words, I'm still working on next week's guest. But there will be a guest, and it will be a good one. And they will. I've got a couple of people kind of lined up. It's just about making sure we get it all sorted out. So there'll be good stories coming the way of our listeners. So, yeah, don't panic.
I'll put my feet up for the weekend.
Exactly. Enjoy the weekend. Good job. Thanks for everything, Gary. Again, producer Gary Hayes. My thanks to Mark Sessler. He was excellent, as I knew he would be. And thank you all for listening. Tell your friends, and we'll be back next week. Bye for now. This episode was hosted by myself, Neil Reynolds. Our producer is Gary Hayes, while Matt Alabaster is responsible for all of our artwork. Taylor Hayes mixed this episode and also composed our theme music. Special thanks to junior producer Henry Smith and everyone else involved in helping us put this episode together. The Neil Reynolds Podcast is a Highway 61 production for the Reynolds Podcast Network.